your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In these next two segments, we are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side for all of you, Rick writes in The No Trader, as well as a piece called 7-11, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, all with the goal to beat the S&P. Now, Rick, as we usually do, we'll jump around from sector to sector and market to market to get your outlooks and your trading strategy on each. But before we get into specific market moves, we do have to address the banking system issues that we are seeing in the U.S. The Fed, the government, even other large banks had to step in this week and last week to help out the lenders, or actually the depositors, as well as some of the other banks. We've had a couple banks go under due to some bad investments. And, hey, look, we're hearing a lot of, let's say, more bearish calls. A lot of people saying this could be the start of a bigger collapse. This is showing two true cracks in the system. Rick, I have to ask you, what's your takeaway from the issues we're seeing in the banking system, and if this truly is the start of something much bigger and worse?
Well, the answer, as far as I'm concerned, Corey, is going to be dependent upon if we break beneath last Friday's close in the S&P of 3862. As we record this on Friday, the S&P right now is down about 40 points or so, just about 3920. So we still have roughly 60 points of playroom, which I don't think is likely going to occur between now and today's close. But what's interesting is still last week, or this Friday, today's close relative to last Friday's close is likely going to be a higher close. Therefore, if next week we break underneath there, especially by next Friday's close, 3862, I think then that does open the door for the bigger down move that certainly more and more people are calling for. But until that happens, the levels that we've been playing so far this year, which is 4148 on the top, where we turn negative in early February, and 3864 on the bottom, which was essentially last week's close, have been the levels that have contained the rally and the decline. And so right now, I think we're still in a trading range, a slight negative bias because of the macro news, but the market's been able to absorb a heck of a lot of selling that took place early this week, and we're still holding above that 3864 level. So when you can see a market absorb the selling like we've seen and still stay above a potential support level, that shows that there really are buyers on this pullback. And those who have kind of panicked out have now actually are walking around with losses. And I think that even led to some of yesterday's rally in the market, is the people who sold closer to 3,800 earlier this week are scampering to, you know, to cover those shorts or sales that were at too low levels. So the bottom line for me is the confirmed bulls and the confirmed bears have yet to been proven right this year. And right now, those who are more shorter term oriented and trading the market and trading the ranges have much more profit to show. Neither bulls nor bears who are confirmed and bigger picture bulls and bears have anything to show for this year. Traders do. And I'm going to kind of stick with that scenario until and if we break under 3860. So last Friday's close was 3862. So I'll use that as my reference level. And if we get a Friday close underneath that, then we up the odds for a move down towards the low 3500s, which is essentially a test of last year's low.
Yeah, Rick, you're spot on that it's been a very choppy market, and both bulls and bears have been frustrated because there has been rallies, there has been pullbacks. It's been very choppy. But maybe you could just unpack that a little bit further about it being a trading market. I mean, that's obvious that you can trade these ranges, but you've been using technical analysis to your advantage, and you've had some very good targets, as you just outlined there, that have kept you on the right side of the fence. Maybe it's just unpack how technical analysis and looking at these trading ranges helps you not get wrong-footed as often as people that are permanently bullish or permanently bearish?
Well, look, I use technicals in conjunction with applying behavioral finance theory directly to the markets, along with market timing and upside and downside exhaustion signals. And when I combine those, we feel like we have a much better handle on the marketplace and the both the shorter term moves and the intermediate term moves than most people who play the game. It's why we've outperformed the S&P. I think it's 6 out of the last 7 years. There's only 1 year we didn't outperform and handily beat the market. So I think most people who use technicals perhaps have a minor edge over those who don't, but you can still be easily proven wrong using technicals if you don't understand bigger aspects to how the markets move, why they move, when they do, and get a real insight into the behavioral decision making of those portfolio managers that actually create bottoms and tops. And we've been able to exploit that for many, many years now. And it's why we have the name and reputation we do, is the constant ability to use multiple forms of analysis to basically have a better handle on what's actually happening in the market. Look, basic technicals can tell you, you know, when a breakdown occurs, but you also get false breakdowns like gold had last year. Where, you know, remember when gold took out 1675 and got down to the low 1600s, and then 6 weeks later turned around and shot forward. So technicals, you know, are not the answer either. I think it's having multiple disciplines, but each one of those disciplines, you have to have an edge in how you use those disciplines compared to everybody else who does. So if you look at fundamentals, if you don't have a true edge and you're looking at the market the same way you were taught, you know, whether it was in college on how to value a company, or if you went and you got your CFA and you're using what everybody else uses, you don't have an edge. If you use standard technical analysis and you're looking at trend lines breaking or moving averages, but those are the same things everybody else is looking at, you don't have an edge. If you're looking at quantitative ways of looking at the market, if your inputs and your factors are the same factors other people are looking at, you're generally not going to have an edge. And even if you put all three together, you don't necessarily have an edge. I think you've got to have an edge in each way you look at the market, because otherwise there's just too many other people looking the exact same way, and there's no way to get ahead of the game. It's part of also, think of this, and you guys know this because you've seen my research for years. We generally trade counter trend. That in and of itself is a far more difficult approach to being successful in the market. But if you can figure out where rallies are going to end and start getting defensive or short near those peaks in price, and you buy when everybody else is selling, but you actually have enough information using your multiple import resources to be buying when the others are dumping out at much lower prices, you have a chance of buying low and selling high, which is exactly what we're all supposed to be doing. And yet 8 out of 10 can't seem to figure out how to do. So it's about having an edge, and the models we use and the experience we bring to the table. Look, I'm doing this over 40 years now, and having the roles I've had on Wall Street, having been a trader in the commodity pits for 12 years on the floor of the exchanges, learning trading at a completely different level than you have when you're an upstairs trader or you're at home sitting trading, being on the sell side at major Wall Street firms as chief strategist, for instance, at Morgan Stanley and other firms, those roles and what you learn in those roles gives you an edge compared to most people who say, oh, we're strategists. And getting insights from having been on the buy side for the years I was, and understanding how a portfolio manager has to approach playing the game, even if it's not the way he wants to, but it's based upon the mandate that, let's say, that firm has, they've got to make decisions that fit the role they're sitting in. And there's ways to exploit that if you understand. And in this case, again, I have the personal experience of having done this. I understand the pressures and some of the limitations a portfolio manager has. And therefore, because of that, I can often exploit the mistakes they make. And to me, that's how we consistently outperform the market and how we buy low and sell high when others are often doing the exact opposite.
So, Rick, this behavioral finance component, I've always found interesting in what you do. And I think this year, out of any, and I guess we can even go back to last year, has been a wake-up call for some people, because behavioral finance understands that people don't make rational decisions. Markets don't always move in rational ways. Do you think that there's always going to be perma bears, perma bulls? You're always going to have those people. Do you think after this last year and a quarter that the perma bulls, they're dissipating? Have they had enough of a wake-up call to start maybe trending back to the middle?
I'd say perhaps they're starting for it, but there's a long way to go before they actually eat the food and become non-bulls. Doesn't mean they become outright bears, but there's so many investors are so ingrained that you buy the dips and you'll do fine if you just hold over time. And that's correct. If you have a 20-year time horizon, a 30-year time horizon, if you're a 25-year-old, a 35-year-old, and you're talking about investing in your 401k or some type of, you know, IRA retirement plan, well, heck, it doesn't matter if the market sells off for 3 years now. 40 years from now, you'll be just fine. It's people who aren't necessarily long-term investors. If you're a 50-year-old, a 60-year-old, a 70-year-old, you have to think very differently. And when you go through a tightening period like we're in now, where the Fed makes it extremely clear what they're doing, and they keep saying rates higher for longer, they can't be more clear. I got to give Chair Powell credit. He has been very upfront with what the Fed's intentions are as best he can without giving away every bit of information, which, you know, he's not going to do. But the basic higher for longer is a clear message of what their intent is to fight inflation. And even though we've had some macro events that in the last week or two have brought rates down very quickly, that is not necessarily going to alter the Fed. Now, there's a Fed rate decision next Wednesday. Might they pause instead of having, you know, continually raise 25 or 50 bips? That may happen. But in the bigger overall picture, they need inflation to still come down well lower than it is. And they're going to do everything they can to make sure that their mandate of full employment and low interest rates is going to be achieved. So there are clear times in the marketplace that simply playing the bullish stance doesn't work. And when you tune into any of the major business TV stations or radio stations, and you hear these perma bulls telling you every single time they're on TV why to be bullish, and yet the market went from 4,800 at the beginning of 2022 to where it is now, with a swing down to 3,500 along the way, and all they do is keep telling you buy, buy, buy. These are people who have not woken up to the fact that there is a major shift that has occurred in the marketplace, fueled by the Fed and by the higher interest rate environment. And they are essentially, in my eyes, hurting their clients, because anybody can tell you to buy, knowing that if you look at a 50 or 100 year chart of the Dow Jones average or the S&P, it goes from the lower left corner of your screen to the upper right hand corner. We all know long term you want to be invested in stocks, but we don't all live in a long-term investing environment. And again, if you're in your 20s or 30s, you can. But if you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, or 70s, you can't. And I think that, to go to your question, is, you know, have enough people shifted away from just buying the dips? No, they haven't. And that's what kind of makes the market still somewhat vulnerable, more than average. You've got a Fed that's not finished doing what they need to do. And you have people that buy dips or hold on to long-term investments and haven't sold out. I have made it abundantly clear in almost every single piece I write to my clients that I use rallies and have continuously used rallies since first quarter of 2022 to lighten long-term exposure to the market, that you will have a better chance to buy these names or stock indexes back lower than simply holding on. And I'm not opposed in the environment that we've had, given the signals we've seen, given the upside exhaustion signals we've seen, given the Fed telling us what they're doing, that you will get a better chance to buy lower. And certainly in the 1,000-point decline that we've seen in the S&P since the peak in January of last year, we've had multiple opportunities to sell on rallies, buy on pullbacks, and replace sales at better levels than where you sold at. So the investing world hasn't completely caught on yet. Many individual investors simply don't know how to sell, except sell at losses. And when they have the opportunity to sell with large, longer-term gains, they don't. And some people say, well, I don't want to pay the capital gains. And that's a viable type of consideration. So you have to take your tax considerations into making some of the decisions you do. But heck, you know, sell covered calls on stocks you own, make some income, do something that at least makes you money as the market pulls back. Because why sit with an S&P that goes from 4,800 to 3,800 doing nothing, just simply hoping that 10 years from now it's higher? Will it probably be higher in 10 years from now? Yes, it probably will be. However, there are opportunities that more than cover your tax burdens in order to play the market. And I don't mean play it day in, day out, but give you opportunities to sell high and buy low. And if this kind of banking crisis leads to a whole nother leg down and you've done nothing, to me, it's just foolish. And you can say, well, you're not really smart enough to know when to buy and when to sell, but and you leave it to your investment advisor. But you have to remember too, investment advisors, as you know, some are good and some aren't. They have a conflict because if they get you to sell out and turn your money into cash, they're not making their fee on your cash. They're only making money in what you've got invested. So when they're collecting their percent, let's say you have a financial advisor and the firm charges 1%, and let's say the advisor roughly gets half of that, usually 40 to 50 basis points out of 100 basis points. The more they put you into cash, the less money they're personally making. So they have a conflict. Of course, they want to do right by you, but they also want to do right. You know, it's very hard to not look at their own pocketbook. So what do most investment advisors tell you? Stick with it, stay with it. We're a near-term pullback over the long term. These are good names to own. They may be, they may not be, but the reality is if they sell out and that turns into cash, they're not making money on those stocks that they've sold you out of. So, you know, there's a natural conflict there. And you have to, every individual, to me, has to pay some attention to what they've got going on in their accounts and not leave it purely up to a financial advisor. That is, to me, not a wise decision. And we can all be busy with work and other things we have, but it's your money and it's your responsibility to be on top of it. And the Fed has made it very clear for many, many, many months now that they are raising rates, and you knew that was not going to be good for owning stocks.
Rick, such good cogent points for people to think about as far as how they manage their investment portfolio, as far as the slight bias with money managers to keep you fully invested all the time and be permanently bullish so they can get those fees. And it's also a great point that you want to be aware of the market swings, because there's no point in sitting in big losses when you can get out and get repositioned at a better place and get a better cost basis, as you've been advising your subscribers and people that follow your work. So appreciate those comments. Now, just on the more micro level of what's happened recently, Rick, I'd love to get your thoughts, because we've seen the risks elevated with all the banking macro situation, but we've seen a lot of the safe havens get a bid. You've seen the VIX go up. You've seen, so there's a lot more volatility in people hedging their bets, but you've seen bonds get a big bid as well as the precious metals, even the yen. So it's just curious that it seems like there's a more defensive posture getting a bid. What do you make of that?
Well, look, the bonds coming off here are a function of a few things. One is you've got a flight to safety. Two is you've got a banking crisis going on. And when we look specifically at the bond market, and let's use the U.S. 10-year as the benchmark, for close to a month before last week, I have been telling clients that if the U.S. 10-year broke 3.8% on a Friday close, don't think about it. Don't try to figure out why. Just buy bonds. And I identified that level and said very few other people are going to pick that level as where support broke. But on one of the models we used, which gave us the prior six lows in the yield, that level had moved up to 3.8 about 3 weeks ago. And so to me, the fact that bonds have broke, we bought bonds, we bought more this week. And I think that there's actually a good chance here that yields are going to head towards 3%. And so I think there's more coming. And that more coming helps cushion the downflow in stocks because, bonds actually had become an alternative investment to stocks. When you have 4% yields, it's not a bad, historically 4% is not a bad place to own some bonds. You don't put all your money in there, but 4% beats the heck out of the 2.5% we've had over the last several years. If they move down to 3%, now people might say, hey, we can shift a little money back into stocks. But because you're in the midst of headlines every day regarding, that started with Silicon Valley Bank and then spread to Signature and then Credit Suisse, and who knows what else comes out over the next week or two, I think bond yields coming off are a sign that there's some real concern. Credit spreads blew out in the last week. The credit spread we watch, a basket of investment grade triple B or better bonds versus comparable maturity treasuries was trading at last Friday or so. I think they were at one point, or Thursday, they were at 1.27%. They're now at over 1.7%. So we've moved over 40 basis points in a week in credit spreads. We're actually very close to last year's high, which was 1.71. I think you've got to watch this spread. It's available, and I'll even tell, all the people listening here, you can watch this spread yourself. The Federal Reserve of St. Louis has a website. It's literally the word Fred, like the first name Fred. It's Fred, even though it's Federal Reserve of St. Louis, it's Fred with an R, .stlouisfed.org. And you can pull up the ICE B of A U.S. Corporate Index Option Adjusted Spread and watch that. And that gives you a very good clue of the direction that stocks are likely to trade to. Typically, in the past, it's been a leading indicator. This year, I'd say it's kind of concurrent. But you want to watch corporate spreads. Historically, fixed income traders are considered the smartest traders of all the asset classes. And you want to get a sense of how they are envisioning the credit quality of corporate bonds versus treasuries. And I watched this like a hawk. We got clients long a small position down at 1.2%. That was the low of the move. And, as I say, it's now about 1.7. And you want to watch this. And just as a reference point, this spread widened out to 4% when the world was falling apart in the spring of 2020, when COVID knocked the heck out of the stock market, and you saw a huge rally in credit spreads, meaning that you got as much as 4% at the peak, 4% higher to own triple B bonds than you did to get comparable dated treasuries. from that 4% level, it sunk all the way down to 86 basis points, and then rallied last year at 1.7, pulled back to 1.2. We got long at 1.2, and now they're trading, where's the one? As of yesterday, it's 1.61. Given how much room there is on the upside, I'm not saying we have to go into any type of situation like we saw when COVID essentially closed the world down, or even first hit up, it's before the whole world was closed. But there's plenty of room to go for credit spreads to widen out, and you want to keep an eye on this. Any investor who watches the stock market, even if you know nothing about the fixed income market, I'm telling you want to watch this spread.
Okay, Rick, thank you. That gives us another thing to keep our eyes on. Let's talk precious metals because those, as Shad said, have been a big beneficiary of these banking issues. You have been playing the long side of gold ever since that false breakdown in Q4 of last year. And now gold is looking like it's about to test some of those highs from this year around 1975. How are you playing the gold market?
So we continue to be long gold. We bought the pullback a week and a half ago. We got long between 1860 and 1810. So we very nicely bought into that pullback. Spot gold on COMEX is at 19, looking at here, 1982. And I think there's a good chance here gold actually pushes to all-time highs. So I like gold. I think that, better to have bought it a week ago, certainly than now. But I do think that this could be the catalyst for gold to get all-time highs. So I don't mind still looking for some pullbacks to get long. I don't know if you're going to get anything substantial now. And we've certainly gone from the false breakdown all the way back towards, we're not quite there yet, but we're towards the top end of the whole trading range and the all-time highs in gold. But I think if you look at how fast gold went from the false breakdown low of, let's say, I don't know, just about 1620 to the high that we made earlier this year at 1975, that's a $350 move. If you add $350 onto the recent low and you're at 1825, that gets you what, 321 and 50, 2175. So certainly new all-time highs, just on what we would call equal legs up. The thrust higher, the pullback, and an equal thrust higher gets you between 2150 and 2175. So I'm a fan of gold. And I think once you get up there, if it can build a base above $2,000 an ounce, then gold really has some room to go over time. And then that also probably means that Bitcoin does. And Bitcoin, has traded perfectly technically recently. It got up to 25,000, which was the high from last summer, the August high. Pulls back, fills the gap a week ago, week and a half ago, and then screams to the upside this week. So Bitcoin's going to be much harder to trade. I actually did a webinar this morning, and I was saying that as far as I'm concerned, the easy money has been made in Bitcoin since that FTX news essentially made the low. That week that the FTX news came out last fall made the low for the move. It never took out that low. So to me, the more that low held, the more Bitcoin was a buy. And we got to that $25,000 level, pulls back to the gap that we said it would fill before moving higher again. But now between 25,000, let's say about 33,000, you've got a whole bunch of resistance from the major breakdown that occurred previously, and it's going to be much harder putting on longs and trying to make money now than it has been in the past. But if you're thinking of gold and Bitcoin kind of in the same type of alternative investment arena, kind of the hedge play against bigger difficulties in the general marketplace, I'd like them both, but I'd rather be in gold than Bitcoin.
Well, Rick, I'm sure some of our listeners will appreciate those thoughts on both gold and Bitcoin as things outside of the traditional fiat system. But one other market we should make a note of that's been going through its own trials and tribulations is the energy space. What do you make of oil and nat gas, but in specific oil? It's had a big move down. It's now in the mid-60s, Rick.
Yeah, so it's bounced a bit. Today we got as low as 65.40 or so. and we're at 66.85, so $1.40 or so off the lows right now. And there is support in the 66 handle. That's a level I identified 2 months ago as a potential downside target. So the biggest thing to me in the oil market, there's two conflicting things right now. On the bullish side, we know that the government has told us that they're going to replenish the strategic oil reserves in the oil market, probably between in and around the mid-60s to $70 range. So we're in a place here that there is going to be some real buying to stem some of the decline. At the same time, up until a week ago, the oil market had gone absolutely nowhere for 6 months, and more specifically, since the beginning of this year. If you're an oil trader, you'll know what I'm talking about here, but in the futures market, and of course, oil is a heavily traded futures contract, the open interest of contracts had increased over 300,000 contracts between January 1st and, let's just call it mid-March, when oil had moved nowhere. That is a 23% increase in commitments to a market that hadn't budged, which means you've got 300,000 new bulls and 300,000 new shorts. Now, it's not individual people, but it's contracts committed to in a market that didn't move. Once a new move started, it would probably get exacerbated because you have so many new commitments in the market over the last 3 months that are going to be on the wrong side of the move. The move down in oil that we're seeing that's kind of taking place this week that breaks underneath all prior lows over the last 6 months should really crack the market. And if it wasn't for the strategic oil reserve replenishing, I think oil could be down to $60 already. Why would it move that fast that quickly? It's because so many new commitments came in the market who are now on the wrong side. If you hadn't seen an increase in open interest, it wouldn't have mattered so much. But because so many new players came in the first 3 months of this year, making a bet either bullishly or bearishly, once you break the trading range, let's just say half those people are on the wrong side. And that's going to exacerbate the move. So not only is oil trading on a three-month low, it's trading more than on a six-month low down here. That, you would think, is going to wash out a heck of a lot of longs in the market. And like I said, we'd probably be down much more sharply if it wasn't for the government doing some buying here. And I would have to think that those who are long are probably beneficiaries of the government buying to at least hold the market in here before potentially going lower. So in that 7-Eleven report that you mentioned at the top of the show, which is my attempt to beat the S&P by being in no more than 7 of the 11 macro sectors at any given time, we lowered our exposure to oil down to the lowest level we've had 2 months ago. We're down to 7% versus a 5% benchmark. We had been over either 10 or we certainly were at 10%, and maybe even for 1 month might have been at 12% exposure to oil. So we had been very, very big oil bulls since the summer of 2021 is when we first turned bullish oil. So we kind of caught very close to the all-time bottom in oil versus the S&P, in energy versus the S&P. And we rode it until earlier this year where we started trimming, and then we trimmed a little more in February and a little more in March. And I think, you know, we've kind of got that right, anticipating that this could potentially be the move in oil that breaks the back. But I am just going to continue watching it because we know the government is a buyer in here. And look, politics aside, you got to give some credit to the Biden administration, who sold oil near $100 and is replenishing it near $65. That's as good a trade as anybody's ever going to make in the business. And again, politics aside, I'm not saying pro-Democrat, anti-Democrat, doesn't matter. I still give credit where credit's due. And I can give credit to the Biden administration for doing this. So kudos to them for at least getting this particular trade right and helping Americans kind of have a good thing happen in the sense that they're replacing $100 oil at much lower prices. So that's a good thing. And, you know, I'm somewhat concerned about energy going forward, but we've got to see what happens with oil here in the mid-60s and whether or not you still get a move down and whether or not at this point it can get itself above 75 or not.
All right, Rick. Great comments as always. Kudos to you for playing these markets and playing the ranges that you have defined, especially over the last few months. It's how the market has played out. Now we have these banking issues that are causing more volatility, but a lot of the levels that you're still watching still very valid and something to definitely consider. Rick, it's great having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time. We'll chat again next month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You guys too. Thanks so much.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.